full of false entrances and dozens of the most devious traps that Leah could devise. Within that narrow space, only the size of a single room, rested Leah's collection of artifacts. In accordance with the rules of Lyriel, she could only summon items from her sanctum. She could also only call them when she was outside the territory. Within the confines of Lyriel, she had to walk into her sanctum and physically pick up anything she wished to use. Most travelers have this restriction, in fact. It was a generally accepted rule in traveler theory that physical transposition could only take place between two different realms. Then again, every rule had its exceptions. A four-pointed crystal star shimmered and appeared in Leah's palm, like a mirage made solid. It shone with a steady light, as though it were a star in truth, though not so bright. Leah's source. This was the only thing she could summon within Lyriel, as, in some way she didn't understand, this crystal was linked to her very essence. With time and concentration, she could funnel her body's energy into the crystal, building it up. The source would store and convert the force, allowing her to summon and empower Lyriel devices. The energy also happened to work as a wonderful currency. Leah closed her eyes and mentally seized power from her source, casting it out like a farmer tossing seed to attract birds. When she peeked at the star-shaped crystal, it had dimmed noticeably. If it went entirely dark, she would barely be able to do anything worthwhile. Even opening a gate would take twice as long. For 2 or 3 minutes, nothing happened. Leah watched the Enosh travelers down below, her skin tingling, her breath coming too quickly. Any second, they could notice. All it would take was for one of them to turn around. Then she felt a vibration in her mind, like a fishing line quivering when the bait has been taken. She turned around to see who, or what, had decided to come. A bluish creature loped up from behind her, leaning on its knuckles to run like a great ape. It was entirely hairless, covered in skin of a faint blue. As it got closer, she could tell that it had tufts of fur sticking out at the wrists and ankles, and above the ears. Closer still, and she could see its 6 eyes. It had 3 sets, arranged on top of one another. One pair of eyes was blue, one white, and one seemed to be green. Leah would have groaned, but she had a long habit of controlling her reactions. She had met this creature before. "Heiress Leah," he said, bowing before her. The movement was strangely graceful, despite the fact that he had to lean on his knuckles to do it. "It has been too long." "I don't have time for this, Selyethan," Leah said. She gestured to the edge of the cliff. "I need your assistance." Selyethan's 3 sets of eyes blinked one at a time, first the top set, then the middle, then the bottom, in quick succession. He ambled up to the cliff and leaned over, taking a look. "Ah," he breathed. "The crystal is yours, I presume, and the traveler's unfriendly." "Can you retrieve the crystal?" Leah asked. The less he knew about her plans, the better. Selyethan chuckled. "If a fair price is paid." Leah held up her source in one hand, but she held her other palm up in warning. "I have conditions. You must only take—" The six-eyed creature ignored her. He reached out one thick, 3-fingered hand, grasping Leah's source. Leah jerked her hand back, trying to pull the crystal out of Selyethan's grip, but he was far too strong. All 6 of Selyethan's eyes closed, and he inhaled deeply. The light in the 4-pointed crystal dimmed, then dimmed again. In seconds, it seemed as if there was a white candle barely flickering in the crystal's depths. Selyethan released his grip, and Leah immediately banished the source back to her sanctum. "How dare you?" she said, feeling both incensed and violated. The source was personal. Too personal to let him grab, certainly. "Give me one good reason why I shouldn't trap you here until you rot." The side of Selyethan's mouth quirked up, showing his amusement. "For one thing, because I have the majority of your power now. I doubt there's anything you could do to me that I couldn't undo." Briefly, Leah considered summoning her crown and teaching him how wrong he was. "Ultimately, though," Selyethan went on, "it's because you need me. And now, dear heiress, I am at your disposal." The blue ape bowed once again, one hand against the ground to keep him from falling over, the other crossed politely in front of his chest. Where had he learned courtly manners in this gray desert? "Get the crystal, Selyethin," Leah said. "Don't disappoint me." Without another word, Selyethin turned and loped away. In the distance, a crystal formation shattered like dropped glass. The Enosh travelers both whipped around to face the noise, the crystals floating behind them spinning like wagon wheels. Behind them, at the base of the cliff on which Leah rested, another crystal exploded. The travelers spun in her direction. Then the ground began to shake, sending sand bouncing into the air. A voice boomed out from nowhere, chanting in an ominous language that Leah couldn't identify. Bolts of white light, like miniature stars, shot out from the crystals behind the Enosh travelers. The lights blasted forward in a string, but the travelers had no target. The shots detonated against a cliff in the distance. Leah couldn't help but admire Selyethin's work. She had no idea what kind of lyrial traveling would make the ground shake like this. But how was this supposed to get her crystal? The two travelers had been distracted, but they were actually backing towards each other instead of running off, moving even closer to Leah's hidden surveillance crystal. How did Selyethin intend to separate them? Leah felt a finger tapping her on the shoulder, and she spun around, calling power from her source. Selyethin stood behind her, his six eyes blinking randomly, holding a crystal out to her in his open palm. "How?" Leah began, but she couldn't finish the sentence. The bluish ape executed a smooth bow, the crystal still extended. "A gentleman must have his secrets." Back in her Enosh rooms, Leah placed the recording crystal in the center of her bed. She drew in one deep breath and called power from her source. In her mind, she saw the source's light sinking to dangerous levels, but she couldn't afford to be stingy now. She had to know what the Grandmasters had discussed, even if it turned out to be nothing more than a routine budget meeting. Sparked by power from her source, the crystal flared to life. It worked something like a shard of her scrying crystal, though not quite as convenient. Within the confines of the plum-sized slice of crystal, an image bloomed. The surface of the crystal wasn't big enough to see the whole room, and it could only watch from one angle, the place where the Lyrial Gate would have opened. In this case, it turned out that the Lyrial Gate would have opened slightly behind and below Grandmaster Asphodel's chair. Leah was treated to a grand view of the soft, round Grandmaster shifting position in her chair, scratching the back of her head, and sighing in frustration or boredom. Her point of view shifted steadily, drifting from right to left at a snail's pace. Every few seconds, the picture would fuzz out to silver dust and then reform. That was due to the cyclical interference of Lyriel's moons, she was sure. But the problems with the image scarcely mattered. The crystal had also captured sound, so now she could hear the Grandmaster's meeting in full. Only a few minutes into the recording, she found herself stunned. "They're going to attack," she thought. She had to act. She pressed a hand against the wall and reached into herself, into her blood, stoking the power there until her hand started to burn. Then she reached out to Ragnaros. The gate to the Crimson Vault tore itself open on the wall, looking out into a familiar set of silver doors. The bearded, one-eyed old man glared at her from the doors, the unnatural red torches to either side giving his face a bloody cast. Even the edge of the Ragnaros gate glowed slightly red, where the image of the vault ended and the mundane wall began. Leah hesitated at the gate. She could only travel through Ragnaros in one direction, to her father's palace in Cana, capital of Damascus. No matter where you entered the territory, you could only exit into Cana. She would have to use Lyriel to return here, which meant a risk. Sometimes, the journey would take seconds. If she was impossibly lucky, the gate for Cana and for her room in the Grandmaster's palace would be only two steps apart. She would enter Lyriel, walk two steps, and open a gate back. However, the moons shifted. It was just as likely that the two points would be 100 miles apart, in which case she would have to either wait until the moons moved into a more favorable position, which could take several nights, or take a horse from Cana's stables and ride to Enosh normally. That would raise a few questions. "This is more important," Leah told herself firmly. She stepped forward into Ragnaros and, before she could reconsider, let the gate close behind her. She turned, putting her back to the silver doors. Odd sounds came from behind her, within the vault. A sort of scratching, tapping sound, like a dozen spiders skittering across stone, and a howling like distant wind. She had to fight the urge to turn back around, since the gate wouldn't work if she tried to open it while facing the vault proper. But facing back the other way was worse. There was no cavern wall behind her, just an empty stretch of darkness. Unexpected smells drifted on the lazy air. One puff of wind brought the smell of ice. Another was tinged with rotting vegetables, and she thought she smelled something like the musk of a huge animal. Being here was always confusing and never comfortable. Best to move on. Tearing a gate out usually took longer than the gate in. Almost a full minute after she had started concentrating, the gate slowly tore itself open, and she looked into her father's palace. More specifically, she looked out into the Blue Room. Queen Sinara, who had originally commissioned this palace, had thought the returning Ragnaros travelers would need a break from all that uninterrupted red, so she made sure that this room, ready to receive returning royal travelers, was completely blue. Blue stone pillars stood at the corners of the room, and the tiles underfoot bore a pattern like the tropical ocean, shifting from shades of green to a deep, almost purple, blue. The ceiling above was painted like a summer sky, with even hints of clouds forming near the walls. Two attendants, both wearing blue instead of the normal red and gold palace uniform, stepped forward. One offered Leah a clean towel to wipe off her face and hands after her journey, and the other bore a pitcher of water. As soon as she stepped through the gate, he poured her a glass. A visitor wouldn't be able to tell, but both servants were actually low-ranking travelers, probably from Tartarus or Asphodel. They were stationed here for two reasons. Their primary purpose was to force back any enemies that somehow managed to infiltrate the palace through Ragnaros. It had never happened, but paranoia had proved itself a healthy habit over Damascus' 3.5-century reign. Their secondary purpose was to be there if anything came through a Ragnaros gate uninvited. Leah had never seen any living creature native to Ragnaros, but she had no doubt they existed. And if one came through, these guards were supposed to do their best to slow it down, before they died. She had never heard of a breach, and her father had once declared that there was nothing to worry about in that regard. But they had to replace these guards with disturbing regularity. Leah took the towel as she stepped down from the pedestal where her gate emerged. Wiping off her hands, she asked, "Where is my father?" One of the servants bowed. "He is personally overseeing the war in Helgard, Highness." Leah turned to the servant and raised one eyebrow. "The war?" "No doubt your Highness has heard of our successful attack on the Helgard Grandmaster." Leah nodded. The Grandmasters had mentioned that fact in the meeting she had recorded, though Leah had already noted that the new, bear-like Grandmaster Helgard was obviously new to the position. "The heretics are attempting revenge, Highness," he said. "Your father has gone to reinforce his travelers on the 21st floor of the tower." "Very well," Leah said. She turned to stride out of the blue room, heading for the Helgard travelers' barracks. "Eris Leah," the chatty servant said again. Leah turned back around. 2 years ago, she would have been piqued and offended that this servant had both stopped her and addressed her by name at the same time. After years in Myria, though, it almost seemed normal. "Yes." "I can take you, Eris," the servant said. He moved his head to the right, revealing a tattoo on the side of his neck, a blue tower. Travelers posted here as guards had almost always done something wrong, usually incompetence or a gross political blunder, and were sent for temporary duty here as a kind of punishment. They were always loyal, but rarely the best in the city, and they were never supposed to reveal their identities as travelers, even to members of the royal family. Well, except in case of emergency. And she supposed this qualified. "Do it, traveler," she said. The man nodded and stepped to one side, his partner rushing out of the room. The Helgard traveler began to chant under his breath, as though he were reciting the lyrics for a song too fast to be understood. Finally, the air bloomed into a swirling vortex of snow, a gate to Helgard. On the other side, she could sense nothing but blowing snow. The bitter cold filled the room in seconds, cutting through her thin brown peasant's dress like an icy knife. "I wanted you to take me to the 21st floor, traveler," Leah said, "not outside the tower." The Hellguard traveler grimaced at her words. He didn't seem bothered by the cold, which she supposed was to be expected. "This is the floor you requested, Highness," he said. "I hate to think why they've called up this much snow, but it's likely not good. The 21st is supposed to be solidly under our control, but this smells like a battle to me." Leah stared into the blizzard. "Well, I can't go in there dressed like this. Send to my rooms, for..." The second servant in blue hurried back into the room, a coat and thick red cloak over one arm, and a pair of high boots in the other. "This was all your bedroom attendants had on hand, Eris Leah," the second servant said, executing a bow. "If you would like to wait, I am sure I could find more." "This will do quite nicely, thank you," Leah said. Her mother had always discouraged her from thanking the help, except in cases of extraordinary service. "When I get back, remind me to promote you." The young man beamed and handed Leah her coat. The Hellguard traveler cleared his throat discreetly. "Eris is the gate to your satisfaction." Leah knelt to lace up one of her boots. The helpful servant stepped forward to assist her, but she waved him away. "I'm sorry, traveler, but I make it a policy to promote only one person per day. And unfortunately for you, this is my favorite coat." Out of the corner of her eye, she saw one servant shoot the other a triumphant grin. Her boots and coat were lined with fur, but they were both bright red, marking her as a member of the royal family. She would show up on a field of snow like a bloodstain. Well, she would have to risk it. Even with her lyrial source as depleted as it was, she was hardly helpless. She flipped up her hood and stepped into Hellguard. The cold air seemed to mock her cloak and jacket, shredding the layers and pressing against her skin like a blanket of ice. She slogged through the snow toward the only landmark she could make out, a low, distant wall of gray stone. Her boots were made well enough to keep out water, which was useful, but her dress was not. Her coat and cloak covered most of her, but snow still found a way to her skin, melting and running down her body in ice-cold rivulets. She couldn't stop shivering. Worse, she started to hear things. Even over the ambient roar of the driving snowstorm, she began to hear the sounds of travelers at war. The snarl of a great cat competed with a call like a distant trumpet. A low, rolling crack, like the sound of a tree snapping under its own weight, shattered the sound of the wind. On the heels of that sound, the ground under her feet shivered and shook. A layer of powdered snow lifted in a ring, blasting away from the gray wall in an invisible explosion. Leah had some severe reservations about walking closer to a battle like that, but she had no choice. This information was too critical to withhold, even to wait for her father's return. Though perhaps she should return to the palace and come back here with an escort of expert Hellguard travelers. No, her safety was secondary. She would have asked the Hellguard traveler on duty in the blue room to accompany her, except the travelers in his position were strictly forbidden to accept any assignments that took them away from the palace. But she could prepare. In her mind, Leah reached out for Ragnaris. Usually, Lyriel would be her preference for self-defense, but her source had reached critically low levels. Until she could replenish its energy, she should save Lyriel for an emergency. A warm weight settled on her head as her royal crown arrived. It was a circlet of polished red-tinted silver, with a single ruby set above her brow. It pulsed with an inner heat, refusing to give in to the cold of Hellguard. The crown's natural resistance to temperature came as a relief, because by all rights it should have felt like wearing a halo of ice on her head. She was cold enough as it was. As she approached the gray wall, a shadow rose up in front of her. Almost 10 feet tall, it stood like a man, but its silhouette was thicker than any human being. As it lumbered closer through the snow, she made out a thick pelt of curly fur and short horns on the head. 7 stones, Leah thought. A Mirka on the hunt. She had never seen one outside of a book. Not that she had ever wanted to. The Mirka leaned forward and roared, close enough that Leah smelled its rotting breath. In one of the Mirka's paws, a huge, jagged icicle began to form, freezing out of nothing. Leah staggered backwards on instinct, but she knew that she would never get far enough in this snow. Mirka were known to be able to hurl their spears of ice hundreds of paces, taking down their prey. What little the Mirka left of its meal would be devoured by hungry ice fangs. Leah focused on her crown, and the ruby began to glow. She would have to use the crown after all, though its after effect would make delivering the news to her father problematic. The Mirka drew its arm back to throw, and Leah opened her mouth to speak, but a clump of glittering snow detached itself from a nearby snowbank and hurled itself at the Mirka's arm. The snow growled and snarled like two bobcats trapped in a sack. An ice fang. An ice fang had attacked the Mirka. Leah felt an instant of profound relief, and then confusion. Ice fangs were scavengers, haunting the snow of Helgard, lying in wait. Why hadn't it ambushed her, the relatively soft and unprotected prey? The cluster of snow bunched up on the Mirka's bicep, tearing off bits of flesh with its hidden mouth. The Mirka roared as a line of dark blue blood ran down its furry arm, and it slammed its giant icicle into the ice fang like a club. The ice fang burst into a cloud of snow. Then a second and a third ice fang burst from the Mirka's feet in a spray of snowflakes. They crawled all over the Mirka's exposed flesh, growling and biting viciously. They must have been summoned. A friendly traveler had to be directing these ice fangs, or they would never have worked together to bring down strong prey with an easy meal nearby. Leah started to walk in a wide circle around the battling creatures, keeping a wary eye on the nearby snow. Patches of innocent-looking snow that glittered as though scattered with broken glass could be ice fangs lying in wait. And if one of the scavengers was on the hunt, a moving furrow on the snow would be all the warning she would get. The Mirka finally managed to throw off or destroy all the ice fangs, and it swiveled its head, sniffing the air, looking for her. Leah sped up, trying to get closer to the presumed safety of the gray wall. But the Mirka spotted her and let out a roar of pain and rage. Practically all its fur was matted down with its own navy blue blood. It took one step toward her. Then the air exploded. It sounded like standing inside a thunderclap. Leah screamed, but she couldn't hear herself. She felt like someone had shoved an ice pick in each of her ears. The rest happened in an instant. Something slammed into the Mirka's side, fast as a bolt of lightning, and Leah got a quick and blurry glimpse of crimson and gold. It hit the Mirka so hard and fast that the beast seemed to vanish, blasted away and out of Leah's sight so fast that she could barely see it move. The wind of the projectile's passing caught her, tore at her cloak, threatened to throw her from her feet. The wind hit her face with surprising heat. Leah stayed standing, but she was having trouble catching her breath. She recognized that terrifying weapon, that deadly force of nature. It was her father's spear. A line of snow had been torn away in the wake of the spear's passing, leaving a path like an arrow from the gray wall in front of her, through the spot where the Mirka had stood, and stretching as far as Leah could see in the distance. Only specks of scorched fur and blue blood on the snow nearby gave any sign that the monster had ever been there. The path was bare soil, totally clear of snow, and it led straight to her father. Well, King Zachareth had been considerate enough to make her a trail. She might as well make use of it. As she had suspected, the Gray Wall was a long, low stone fortification outside one of the Damascan outposts in Helgard. The travelers hurriedly opened one of the side gates, beckoning her inside. As they brought her in, leading her to a fire and to her father, they caught her up on the situation. The Damascans had managed to kill Grandmaster Helgard barely 2 days ago, in real time, but Helgard had experienced a time spike since. For the travelers here, it had been over a week. The Helgard travelers loyal to Enosh had used that time to assault this fort on the 21st floor, as the nearest Damascan outpost of any real size. "They were pulling out all the stops, too," the traveler said. He shuddered and stared off into the distance, though he didn't stop walking. I had never seen a frost giant before. From his expression, Leah didn't think he would want to see another one, either. As soon as the time spike had stabilized, late this past afternoon, they had sent for reinforcements from the capital. Without them, the Hellguard travelers here wouldn't have lasted the night. However, they had not expected the king himself. Zagareth and his deadly spear had proved enough support that the Enosh travelers had reconsidered. They had pulled back to regroup before Leah reached the wall. Leah considered the implications of that. Why was the king here in person? There were only a few possibilities. Either he didn't have any other travelers to send, unlikely, or he thought this situation important enough to warrant his personal attention. Why? Either way, she felt somewhat responsible for the Hellguard travelers here. Her news was likely to make the king return to Cana, and they would be left here with no backup. Well, the stability of the realm came first. They could always come back and recapture their lost outposts later. The Hellguard traveler led Leah into an ordinary sitting room. It was hardly fit for Damascan royalty. The walls were made out of rough, barely cut stone, and the furniture was simple wood. Four chairs rested around a heavy, barely polished table, and the hearth at the end of the room blazed with flame. At least it was warm. Leah hurried over to the fireplace, pressing her body as close as she dared. It probably wasn't wise, but she barely gave any attention to the room's other occupants. Tallow sat at the table, his sheathed sword in front of him. Maybe half an inch of its red blade showed. Upon seeing Leah, he ran a hand through his golden curls and flashed his sister a perfect grin.
"Playing with the Mirka, Leah."
Leah ignored him, lowering her hood to feel the full warmth of the fire on her face. Her dress underneath was wet and cold, and somehow her body actually shivered more now that it was getting some relief. She supposed that was her way of transitioning from the cold. She would have pulled the heavy cloak from around her, leaving her in her dress and jacket, but she felt incapable of moving.
"You're careless," King Zagareth said to her.
He sat at the head of the table, behind her, though she had caught a glimpse of him as she came in. He was clothed fully in his royal armor, plates of dark metal lined in gold and set occasionally with rubies. It was not ornamental, that armor. The gems were mined from Ornheim, and in some way she didn't understand, they added strength to the armor as a whole. He had worn the armor into dozens of battles, and it bore the marks to prove it, dents and dings and scratches that represented attacks. Attacks that had never come close to wounding the man inside. A number of clever replies rose to Leah's tongue, but only one thing escaped.
"I'm sorry, father," she said.
She had been trained well.
"Take an escort with you next time," Zagareth went on.
He was never one to abandon a battle just because he had already won.
"You can't count on me being there to save you every time."
"Perhaps we should ask why she's here," Tallow said. "Surely it must be something urgent for her to risk running into Hellguard alone."
Zagareth stared at her so hard that she could have sworn she saw a red light pulse against the fireplace. Red light shining from his crimson eye. She shuddered, and it wasn't because of the cold. She didn't speak. She wasn't sure that she could make her jaw move.
"I know why she's here," Zagareth said. "I see the moons of Lyriel upon her. She found a way to spy on the War Council of the Grandmasters."
Out of the corner of her eye, Leah saw Talos look up sharply. He seemed almost panicked. Well, he probably worried about what the Grandmasters were up to.
"That is true, father," Leah said between shivers.
She reached into a pocket and withdrew her recording crystal, turning to place it on the table in front of them.
"I've only watched the first few minutes," Leah continued, "but what I heard was enough to alarm me. The Grandmasters plan to take this opportunity to attack us. They will assault some of the overlords, trying to damage the tree, and I suspect that they also intend to reinforce the Valenhal incarnation."
Zagareth stared at the crystal. He did not ask her to activate the recording, though she knew he soon would. He appeared carved out of granite as he sat there, lost deep in thought. Talos did not have his father's patience.
"We should gather the overlords," Travel to them now. We can abandon this outpost and focus everything we have on destroying the Incarnation.
Where is the Incarnation now? Leah asked.
Talos looked to their father, who continued to stare a moment before answering.
The Incarnation of Valenhal stands in what was once the village of Harrenfell. According to reports we have just received, he marched into the village at dawn, challenging anyone who stood in his way to duels. He spared the lives of those that acquitted themselves well, and killed the rest. Harrenfell is now a graveyard.
Anger showed in Talos's eyes. This is exactly the kind of thing we should be there to prevent. Where will he be heading next?
Harrenfell, Harrenfell, Leah mused. That's in Lysander's realm, isn't it? It's southeast of the Lotari Forest.
Zachareth nodded in her direction.
The Valenhal Incarnation travels in a straight line, from his grave at the center of the Lotari Forest to his destination. He will walk through any obstacle until he reaches the royal palace in Cana and slays me.
Leah took a moment to digest that information. Talos' eyes widened, then narrowed, as though he had heard something that would change the entire game. He was probably thinking about how to allow the Valenhal Incarnation to assassinate his father, leaving the succession open. Leah's thoughts went in a different direction.
How do you know that? Leah said.
Maybe he wants to slaughter indiscriminately to satisfy some mad urge. Zachareth met her gaze with eyes of blue and red. Leah tried her best not to look away.
I know the man he was, the king said. I cannot think that incarnation has changed him so much.
Talos leaned forward, one hand almost unconsciously brushing his sheathed sword.
How do you know so much about him?
Because I was the one who sealed him in that grave, Zachareth replied. In a way, my actions led to this. I decided to place a 10th inmate in a prison built for 9.
Neither of them had anything to say to that.
Talos broke the awkward silence. I will leave now. We should mobilize all the soldiers and travelers we can gather, and stop this incarnation directly. We can warn the overlords to be on alert, to defend their trees, but if we can take care of this incarnation now, we will have disarmed the Grandmaster's primary weapon. Perhaps Indiriel can even lure this incarnation back to his home territory.
That wasn't a bad plan, actually. Incarnations became trapped if they stayed too long in the territories that created them. Her tutors had said that this was because the incarnations were part of the territory's power, and by returning, they became absorbed in their world's fabric. She hardly understood the theory behind that, but she didn't need to. As long as incarnations couldn't move miles and seconds through their territories, she was satisfied. Zachareth continued staring at Leah, his expression as unyielding as the face of a hammer. She knew what he wanted. He only got that look when he wanted her to prove herself. Leah gave a mental sigh. She wasn't fool enough to sigh out loud to her father's face, and spoke.
We need to consider the opposite strategy, Leah said. We may want to determine which overlords the Grandmasters will attack and prepare traps there. In the meantime, we send a token force to oppose the incarnation, or else send no one.
Talos let his chair fall forward on its front legs, sending a thunk echoing through the sitting room.
If we send no one, the incarnation will slaughter at his leisure. The villagers will have no chance. They will fall by the dozens.
It's an option we must keep in mind, Leah said. The Grandmasters may or may not accompany the incarnation, but they will attack the trees. If we can ambush them there, then we can remove the Grandmasters, who represent a significant portion of the Enosh fighting force. Besides, even if we stop the Valenhal incarnation and save dozens or hundreds of lives, losing the hanging tree will release the other incarnations. Thousands more will die. Tens of thousands.
King Zachareth leaned back in his chair and gave her one brief nod of approval. Her heart swelled with pride, though she tried to ignore it. She was a grown woman, and she didn't like her father much. The man's opinion should mean nothing to her. But approval or encouragement from her father was as rare as sunshine in Helgard. Talos's face twisted. He sneered at them, and it did terrible things to his expression. He didn't look like a hero now, just a broken and bitter man.
You two. You're the same as Sinara and Edessa. You have no thought for those beneath you. Do not speak of things you do not understand, King Zachareth said.
He did not sound angry, but Leah edged back, close enough to the fire now that the heat felt scalding, even through three layers of clothing. Even if her cloak caught fire, it was better than standing between two angry Ragnaros travelers.
I understand enough, Talos said.
He gripped his sheathed sword in one hand, pulling it to his side.
I understand that you are more concerned about your rule than about the people who trust you.
He did not put his other hand on the sword's hilt, which was likely the only reason that their father allowed him to remain conscious.
If you were king, you could do as you wished, Zachareth said. Fortunately, you are not, and you will do as I say.
You are not fit to rule, Talos spat.
Leah shot a glance to the door and started trying to calculate how quickly she could rush out of the room. Zachareth stared at his one remaining son, and Talos stared back. Neither said a word. After a tense minute, Talos looked away.
It's pointless speculating, Talos muttered. We don't have enough information.
Their father didn't acknowledge Talos's words, but he did stand and gather Leah's recording crystal from the table.
I will return to the palace and have this examined, he said. My advisors and I will determine our course of action. You will both remain available until a decision is made. Talos, stay here and do what you can to keep the Grandmasters from taking this outpost. It's more important than you think. Leah, return to Enosh and gather what other information you can, but do not expose yourself unnecessarily. I will count on having you alive and capable in whatever defense we fashion.
Yes, Your Highness, Leah said.
She dipped a little curtsy, hurriedly stepping forward when she realized she had almost trailed her cloak in the flames. King Zachareth turned and swept from the room, his boots clanking on the floor, leaving Leah alone with her brother. Now that their father was gone, Talos turned his glare on her.
You would give in to him so easily?
Leah shrugged. Not giving in, but considering all options. Whichever course of action results in the least life, that's the one we will take.
Even at the cost of entire villages? Talos said. Who are we, that we make such decisions? You lived in a village for your trial, just as I did. Imagine that it was your village with an incarnation rampaging through. Imagine that you had to watch, powerless, as he tore apart faces you knew, people you loved. Seven stones! Isn't your mother's family from a village? What if it was their lives at stake?
Leah knew what he was trying to do, though she couldn't help but picture what he described. A long sword jutting from the chest of her half-sister, Rutha. Her aunt Nurita, cut down as she tried to organize a resistance. Kaim and his family, stuck in their home as it collapsed around them. Alan's sisters, butchered by an insanely powerful creature that knew no reason. She shuddered.
It's a horrible thought, she agreed. But sometimes the alternative is even worse.
Talos hurled his sheathed sword down to the table in anger, pacing restlessly from one side of the room to the other.
Is it? Is it worse? Why is that always the justification we use, that the alternative is worse? We sacrifice 9 of our own citizens every year, citizens we were meant to protect. And now we're considering letting even more of our people die. What could be worse than that?
It's mathematics, Talos, Leah said quietly. If it costs us 9 lives to save 10, then as responsible rulers, there's only one choice we can make.
Her brother met her eyes, and in his face she saw the expected rage, frustration, and condescension. He always thought that anyone of any intelligence should see things the same way he did. But she also saw something she did not expect, a deep, compelling pain.
I got to know them in my trial, Talos said. They became close to me. One
one in particular.
Sinara found out.
Leah winced. Ruthlessness ran in her family's blood, but her oldest sister had inherited a double share, along with a sadistic streak.
"The one I loved," Talos went on. "She was chosen as the first offering on the 354th sacrifice. I was away, on assignment for Father. I didn't learn about it until later."
"What did you do?" Leah asked. But she knew.
Her sister Sinara was paranoid and delusional, forever trapped inside her palace rooms. Someone had done that to her. Talos put a boot up on the seat of his chair. He looked regal again, once more like the heroic prince from the stories. "Her trial was in Asphodel. There are no crimes out in the mist. And once the fear sets in, once she started to panic, the mist began to feed on her. She will never forget what her cruelty cost her."
"I'm not sure it was her cruelty," Leah said.
Her brother pointed a finger in her direction. "You're right. It wasn't hers. It was ours. We all perpetuate this system while we're a part of it. We keep these incarnations enslaved, and we pay lives to do it. Well, there are other ways. The whole system will burn to the ground, and we will build a new one on top of it. A better one."
Talos was staring past Leah now, into the hearth full of flickering flames. Leah shivered, and not from the cold. Her brother may have started with pure motivations, but they were twisted, wrong. "I could use him," Leah thought. She cursed herself. Why was that so often her first thought? As she watched her brother stare silently into the flames, she couldn't help but wonder about him. He could not be allowed to take the throne, that was for sure. But in that case, who else was left?
Chapter 9. The Incarnation of Valenhal. 358th year of the Damascan calendar. 24th year in the reign of King Zacharath VI, 31 days after midsummer, 14 days until summer's end. Simon emerged from the healing pool with an imp still gnawing on his shoulder. Kai spun Azura in an arc, slicing the creature in half and sending its two pieces flying off the splash in the pool. The imp didn't bleed, and Simon had the distinct impression that it would eventually pull itself back together.
"Thank you for saving me, sir," Simon said, pulling his clothes back on. It took him a moment to notice that they were still stained with blood. Simon held up his blood-stained shirt in front of Kai.
"Where are the Nye?" Simon asked. "Did I not wait long enough?"
Kai was stroking the flat of Azura's blade like a lover, staring deep into her silvery surface.
"It's not your fault, little mouse," Kai said. "The Nye have other concerns today."
"Does that happen often?"
"Never," Kai said. "This is something of an exception, and the reason why I was looking for you in the house. We have a problem."
"A problem?"
"You're full of useless questions, aren't you?" Kai said.
He held Azura in his right hand. He seemed not to want to let go, and gestured to Simon with his left.
"Hurry up, if you would. We have places to go, people to save."
Simon pulled on his shirt, wincing at the feel of sticky blood against his scars, and ran after Kai. He led Simon back to the garden, where a familiar figure was engaged in conversation with Chaka. He wore road-stained clothes of brown and green, and looked as though he was about a week overdue for a shave and a haircut. He held a dragon's fang in his right hand, and had a huge red and gold book tucked under his left arm.
"Dinner," Kai called. "We are ready."
Dinner said something and bowed to Chaka, who bowed back. The leather man didn't spare Simon more than a glance. Dinner jogged over to join Kai and Simon. Simon started to say something, but as soon as Dinner was close enough, Kai grabbed Simon by one arm and began pulling him out of the room.
"Hold on," Simon said, pulling himself free. "What is going on?"
"This is somewhat urgent, little mouse," Kai said. "Please scamper in this direction, if you would."
He seized Simon by the shoulder this time and kept guiding him out. Denner sighed, but he kept following Kai.
How have you been, Simon? He asked.
Well enough, Simon replied, struggling in Kai's grip. Short of calling Steel, he didn't think he could break it. Haruman, the book under Denner's arm, chuckled. He spoke in a stuffy, cultured voice.
You have been well enough, I'm sure. Assassinating overlords, destabilizing the realm. I hear you're quite the wanted man in Damascus, which is highly inconvenient, considering that's where...
He cut off as Denner slapped him on the binding.
Sorry about that, Simon. Sometimes he runs away without me.
It's no problem, Simon said, but he felt a little queasy. He had barely considered how he would be treated in Damascus because of what he'd done. Come to think of it, though, he had killed dozens of soldiers. It had always seemed like he had a good reason at the time, but he was a murderer. A murderer? Would they lock him up in some jail he couldn't break his way out of? Maybe even exile him to some terrible territory?
Don't worry, little one, Kai sang, still dragging Simon behind him. You'll kill more before all this is through. You've barely gotten started.
The thought made Simon so sick, he thought he would lose his last meal all over the Vallenhall hallway. He rarely thought in those terms, killing, murder. He thought of what he did as fighting, becoming stronger, defending the innocent. Somehow, those terms made him feel better.
We're not sure if you've heard, Haruman piped up, but the Vallenhall incarnation has escaped his prison.
Kai told me, Simon responded. The Grandmasters didn't seem to think it was worth mentioning, though. You'd think they would have told me that there's a rampaging incarnation from my territory.
They probably didn't want to tell you any more than they had to, Denner said.
Did they seem like they were trying to keep information from you, keep you in the dark? Before Simon could respond, Kai placed his palm on Simon's back and firmly pushed.
Less talking, more walking, little mouse.
What is the hurry? Where are we going?
The village of Harrenfell, Denner responded.
They reached the entry hall, and Denner raised his sword. He slid it down, slicing open a Vallenhall gate, and doing it more smoothly than Simon had ever been able to manage.
Where is Catherine? Kai asked. Is she waiting with Indiriel?
Denner sighed again, shaking his head.
She has a life outside us now. She made it clear that if I wanted her to go anywhere near our old master, I was going to have to duel her for it.
She has the life you all wish you did, Haruman said. Her skills have made her quite rich, as I understand, and renowned in certain circles. I have always said that you could have made a better life for yourself, Denner, if you would only...
Denner finished making the gate and stepped through, cutting off his advisor. Kai made sure that Simon followed before bringing up the rear. He still held Azura, which Simon thought he could understand. Surely Kai missed holding his old sword, and if the dolls were still talking to him, that had to comfort him. He carried Angeline with him now, a blonde doll in a black dress with a serious expression. Simon hadn't heard her say a word to him, but Kai still cradled her as if she would speak at any second.
Wait a minute, Simon thought. Wasn't Kai going for his own sword? Where is it?
It was taken, Angeline said. We hope he will earn it back soon.
Simon wished that didn't sound so ominous. The gate opened on a field of patchy and dying grass, surrounded by white tents. The tents were lit only by starlight and the occasional candle. Soldiers moved around in the business of war, sharpening weapons, polishing boots, hauling chests from one tent to another. A few soldiers were sleeping, but fewer than Simon had expected, considering that it was the middle of the night. Obviously, travelers were a common sight in this camp, because only a few soldiers looked up curiously at the sight of three men stepping out of nowhere. Most of the men were either out of uniform or half-dressed, so it took Simon a handful of seconds to recognize their red and gold clothes as the uniform of the Damascan Royal Army. These soldiers were led by no single overlord, instead serving the kingdom as a whole. Simon dropped into a fighting crouch, and one hand went to the side as if to summon Azura.
"Put your fangs away, little mouse," Kai said.
He smiled when he saw Simon's outstretched hand.
"We are among friends."
He seemed amused though it was hard to tell with his hair veiling his eyes. They simply stood in the center of the camp for a minute or two, letting the soldiers bustle and hurry by them. "What are we waiting for?" Simon asked finally. Neither of the others responded, but Dinner nodded to a stranger who jogged down one of the aisles between tents to meet them. He was tall and fit, perhaps in his 40s, with barely a few specks of gray in his dark hair. His skin was dark, too, a villager, and when he flashed them a grin, it was wide and friendly. He wasn't wearing a uniform, only black pants and a white shirt with the sleeves cut off, revealing long, heavily muscled arms. Simon stared at the man's arms for a moment, almost in shock. Black chain marks snaked up this stranger's arms almost to the elbow. "He's a Valenhall traveler," Simon thought. "Dragon army. What is he doing with the Damascans?"
"Leading," Angeline replied. "The dragon army once opposed Damasca, true. But with Valen's fall, well, Indiriel had different opinions than the rest."
The traveler, Indiriel, came to a stop facing the three of them. He beamed. "It's been too long, my friends. You look well." Denner smiled back, but he didn't say anything. Kai shook his shaggy white head.
"We are not here for this, Indiriel."
Indiriel rolled his eyes. I know, but give me a moment to pretend we're still friends." He turned his gaze to Simon, and his smile grew more gentle. "And you must be Simon. You've grown." Simon froze. He pictured this stranger, Indiriel, in a black Nye cloak like the one he wore. There were only a few things he remembered about the man who had saved his life. Bare, chain-wrapped arms, a long and ragged sword, a black cloak, and a gleaming smile. Indiriel didn't wear the cloak, but his smile was the same. Simon felt as he had when Benson, the steel skeleton, had kicked him in the chest and sent him flying. He had all but given up on finding the man who had saved his life when he was a child. Valenhall travelers were more scarce than ever now, and he had come close to convincing himself that his savior must have died over the years. But this was him. This had to be him. He was on the verge of speaking when a woman ran up to Indiriel. She wore brown buckskin clothing and feathers in her hair, an Avernus traveler, like the one Simon had met in Enosh. However, the few travelers he had seen had worn feathers of brown, black, or gold. Hers were broad and white, sticking up in a fan over her left ear.
"Overlord Indiriel," she said, bowing. "We found a group of survivors. They were headed for Tyrus."
"Bring them here, to the others," Indiriel responded. "Move as fast as possible. If you can find a few more of those eagles, fly them back. We don't know when that monster will return."
"Sir," she said, saluting.
"Send them to me as soon as you can," Indiriel said. "I want to know when we've caught them all." The Avernus traveler hurried off, past the row of tents. As soon as she had enough free space around her, she raised what seemed to be a feather to her mouth and blew. It made a sharp whistling sound that somehow managed to cut through the rumble and bustle of the soldiers' night. A distortion, like heat haze, briefly hid the stars over her head, and a giant white eagle appeared out of nowhere, as though it had simply come into being mid-dive. It landed on the ground next to her, feathers pure white, and nestled the traveler's head with its cruelly hooked beak. The traveler rubbed its head for a moment, and then hopped onto the bird's back. She pulled a pair of goggles from a pouch at her side. Simon had seen those before, in Enosh, and strapped them to her head. She and the eagle both flew off. Simon watched them go, his mind whirling. Overlord Indiriel? The man who had saved his life was a Damascan overlord?
"You're an overlord?" Simon asked. He barely recognized his own voice.
Indiriel's smile faded, but he nodded. He seemed to know exactly how Simon felt, and he had a look of patient acceptance on his face. Haruman made a sound like he was clearing his throat.
"Simon, son of Kalmon," the book said, "I have the honor to introduce Indiriel, son of Elias, overlord of the realm of Cana and bearer of the first Dragon's Fang. He's a personal friend of ours."
"I've missed you, Haruman," Indiriel said. "We should catch up. I know a few things that might interest you."
"Oh," the book responded, "I have simply nothing but time, Indiriel. I am entirely at your disposal."
Denner sighed. Indiria looked around for a moment. Where's Catherine?
She couldn't make it, Kai said softly.
Indiria squarely met his gaze. Due to some trauma in her youth, I'm sure, he said. Kai didn't respond. Well, gentlemen, it's time to get to work. Indiria strode off down the row of tents, not watching to make sure the others were following. Simon did so, mind reeling. Indiria was an overlord. How many had he sent to the sacrifice? Why had he saved Simon's life? Surely it was his travelers who had attacked Simon in the first place. This camp is outside of what used to be the village of Harnfell, Indiria went on. A few hours ago, Valen came knocking. We're taking you to interview some of the survivors now. He stepped over a soldier who had passed out and fallen outside of his tent.
Valen, Simon said.
He was having trouble processing all the new information he had received in the past few hours. I thought this was the Valenhall incarnation we were after. Indiriel stopped. He turned around, but he didn't look at Simon.
Wow, Kai, he said. You haven't told the boy anything, have you?
Kai smiled, but it was a rigid thing, like the rictus of a corpse.
It was never supposed to be me that trained him in the first place.
The Overlord ignored that, focusing on Simon. Valen was the first of us, he said. He was also the first to fall. You can draw almost as much power from Valenhall as you can handle, but if these, he tapped his forearm, which was almost covered by the black chain marks, ever cover you completely, you stop controlling the power, and the power starts controlling you. He straightened and continued walking. We call that process incarnation.
They keep saying the Valenhall incarnation, though, Simon said. Is there only one?
Haruman made an excited sound.
Please, Indiriel, allow me, the book said. For the most part, territories are only embodied in a single incarnation at a time. If one traveler loses control, he becomes an incarnation. Well, then, you may wonder what happens when a second traveler reaches that point. Excellent question. Often, they simply die on the spot.
Simon resolved to keep a closer eye on his chains in the future.
Of course, Haruman went on, there are a few memorable occasions where travelers have lost control of their power and simply had their minds destroyed by the Force. Still others have actually become creatures of their territory themselves and were consumed by their incarnation. Either way, it is theoretically impossible for two incarnations of the same territory to exist simultaneously.
Here we are, Indiriel said. He swept aside the flap for a tent that, to Simon, looked identical to hundreds of others. Inside, a man crouched in the dirt. He wore the outfit that Simon was used to seeing from the village. Tan shirt, brown pants held up by a stretch of rope. Very similar to the clothes that Simon wore now, in fact, and in much the same condition. This man's clothes were covered in almost as much blood as Simon's. This man clutched a sheathed sword to his chest and shuddered, staring off into space. He held the sword as tightly as if it were his only child. The two guards, in the red and gold of the king's army, stood and saluted when they saw Indiriel.
No change, sir, one of the guards said. He stayed put the whole time.
Indiriel thanked the soldier and went down on one knee, looking the shaking man in the eye.
What happened? Indiriel asked softly.
At first, Simon didn't think the man would answer. He kept shivering and looking off in the distance. But after a few more seconds of that, he turned and met Indiriel's gaze.
There was a swordsman, he whispered. A swordsman with black eyes. He showed up at the edge of town and just started walking. But his sword was so big. It was that big.
The man noticed Azura, and his eyes widened. He pointed.
That big? The sword looked like that. Where did you get that sword?
By the last word, he was practically panicking.
Kai, Indiriel said, his voice a razor, would you please banish Azura?
Kai said nothing, but he held Azura's hilt out to Simon. Simon took the sword in both hands, but without calling steel, he could barely hold it upright. It only took a brief effort of will to cast the blade back to Valenhall. Indiriel noticed. He stared at the space where Azura had once been and looked at Kai,
raising his eyebrows in question. Kai shrugged. The shivering man's eyes widened even further.
"Travelers," he whispered. "You're travelers."
He squeezed his eyes shut.
"Maker be praised," he said. "Now he'll get what he deserves. Travelers will settle for him. He'll finally get his justice."
"Please, tell me what happened," Indiriel said again. He didn't sound angry. In fact, he sounded quite patient. Simon would have expected an overlord to make demands, not to ask politely. He had only spoken with Malachi for a minute or two, but the man had spoken like a king until he saw his family in danger. Indiriel seemed somehow more human.
"He was just walking," the man went on, "but his sword was so big and so sharp, it started cutting people. First, it sliced through one of the ox lines. Not like he meant to do it, like he didn't care where his sword went or what it cut. The ox ran off, and it was old Benai's. Benai got mad, so he yelled at the guy. And the swordsman, he looked at Benai, and that was when we could see that he had black eyes. He told Benai that if he wanted him to stop, he should get a weapon. The guy kept walking. Benai, well, he had seen the guy's eyes. He screamed and started to run, but the swordsman stabbed him in the back." The man squeezed his eyes shut. "He called Benai a coward. He said that if any of us deserved to live, we should prove it. And he brought the sword down like he was cutting the air itself. And 1,000 shadows came out."
Simon stared at the man, horrified and sick. At least now he knew where the Nai had gone.
"They were everywhere, these shadows. They choked. They had these chains."
The man started crying. Simon looked away uncomfortably. He could imagine what kind of horror this man had endured, but it still felt wrong to him to watch a grown man cry.
"We know," Indiriel said gently. "Trust me, we know."
"How did you survive?"
"My brother had this sword, and I knew about it," the man said. "When we were kids, we would take turns practicing with it, pretending, you know. So I got it. When one of the shadows came for me, I managed to stab it through the chest. It sort of slithered away, like a snake."
The look in the man's eyes became pure horror.
"Then he came."
"Were you in his way?" Denner asked. He sounded more curious than anything else, which surprised Simon until he thought about it. Surely Denner must have heard even worse stories than this one. The man shook his head.
"It seemed like when I killed this shadow, like he started looking for me. There was a wagon in his way when he walked toward me, and he cut it in half and kept walking. When he came into my house, instead of using the door, he cut his way through the wall. I stood there, frozen, you know. But I was on my feet, and I had my sword."
He clutched his sword tighter.
"The man with black eyes, he said, 'Come out of your house if you deserve to live. Prove it.'"
The Overlord interviewed two more witnesses that night. Their stories were the same. Anything the black-eyed swordsman ran into